Funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Every time the news invades our lives, the news storyteller rises in prominence. It might be a war correspondent's front page dispatch. It might be the sound of a radio reporter's voice. But for most Americans, it's the television news they tune in. Politicians and newsmakers know this. They measure their opportunity to seize the agenda by their ability to command the cameras. And television news is watched not just for the range of stories it chooses, but also for the manner in which it covers them. Peter Jennings deals with both aspects, delivery and content, as anchor and senior editor of ABC News World News Tonight. In the past year, that adjective world has taken on more significance, with reporters reevaluating the relationship between the we and the they in news coverage, reporting on patriotism and vulnerability at a time when many journalists are feeling those sentiments as much as they are observing them. Connection listeners, as President Bush tries to prepare the country for a new war with Iraq and continues to wage his war on terror, what are your expectations of network television news? Our guest this hour is Peter Jennings, anchor and senior editor of World News Tonight. And Connection listeners, you know the number. We're 1-800-423-8255. Peter, welcome to the studio.
Nice to see you. Meet you at last.
You're out of the ABC studios because you're talking about a new book that you helped write, In Search of America, which is part of a television series and is now in bookstores. It, if I understand it, is an attempt to sort of check in on what the founding fathers intended and see whether or not some of those principles still exist.
Close. To just check in, I think, is the main thing. I mean, it's a collection of stories that we've been doing for the last 2.5 years with that irresistible urge that journalists have to go out and get under the skin of the country whenever they possibly can. But we wanted to see, obviously, because this country, as you and I both know, because we both came from somewhere else, is more an idea than anything else. And the founding fathers gave the country and the Constitution a framework which they anticipated would be modified and changed and altered generation by generation. We wanted to see how the country was doing in that context. And then 9/11 came along sometime after we've started and, you know, shifted the axis once again and focused us much more. So we've had a wonderful time. So it's true, I am here in connection with the book, but I'm also in this perpetual search that I'm always on and have been on for X number of years to try to understand the country better. And any time I can go anywhere besides New York, I'm delighted.
Was there a great grinding of gears in the offices of the people who are designing the book in the weeks after September 11th? We've got to throw out everything we've done. We need to go back to all these places. We need to start over.
No, but Todd Brewster, my partner, who also I did The Century with and who worked on the television series with me, he and I clearly stopped dead on 9/11 like the whole country did and had that same sense of vulnerability. And people did come and say, well, maybe you guys want to start again and do something different. And we talked about it for a while and then decided actually what we'd set out to do in the first place was the real thing to do, that it was even more important now to reacquaint ourselves, I mean this us in the very general sense, with what the country stands for and what the country's values are, given, as you've mentioned in your opening today, that the country now perceives itself A, as vulnerable, and B, as having a new indeterminate enemy. And even more so, I think, now, as you mentioned, that the president may take the country to war in the Middle East. So for us, it was a really good time to stick with the basics. You know, what are the country's values in terms of religion, free enterprise, the American ideal, and the rest of the world? Who are we as a people? So we actually didn't change gears very much at all. We went back and checked in with some people. And in at least a couple of our chapters, people were deeply involved in their own individual search when 9/11 occurred, and that changed it quite dramatically.
It is always in times of great crisis that we do refer back to history. And on September 11th, Peter Jennings was behind the desk at ABC News in New York talking a little bit of history and context of what was happening on that day.
I guess it's also clear to people now that ABC News is going to stay on the air for an indefinite period of time. For a variety of reasons, of course. One is to continue reporting the news, which is our job. And secondly, because of something that an American historian once said to me many years ago, that the television set is roughly equivalent to a campfire in the days as the wagon trains were making their way westward, and there was a catastrophe on the trail, and some people pulled the wagons around and sat down and discussed what went on and tried to understand it, and then went on the next day. And we do that in front of our television sets now in large measure today. We did it, you'll recall, at the time of the Challenger. We did it when President Kennedy was assassinated. We've done it in any number of incidents, whether we're working on television or watching television or contributing to it in some way. This is, in some respects, the national campfire.
Curious thing, though, Peter, about the national campfire is that we spend as much time talking about the wood that's in the fire as the light that it's throwing. I mean, and that's the curious position that you occupy as both senior editor and anchor of ABC News, in that you're the lightning rod for criticism when the media is perceived to get something wrong or get something wrong, and the architect of what comes next and what comes after.
Yes, I must say, in one respect, I'm very glad you picked that soundbite. It was Dan Boorstin, a great American historian, who told me that story right after the Challenger disaster, when I was, as I think we all might have been, overwhelmed by the depth of feeling that was felt throughout the country and how people had gathered around the television set. And it happened again on 9/11. I don't mind ever being the lightning rod. And I have a rule, which is very simple. If people criticize us, they must be heard. And secondly, if they criticize us and we're wrong, we must acknowledge the fact that we are wrong. I don't have a stiff spine about being right when I am not. But the far more interesting part of the job, of course, is to try to ignore that aspect of the job in many cases and be the architect of what is coming down the pike. Because that is really, and I think people probably appreciate this, this is where the real power of the journalist or the editor or the anchor resides in choosing what it is to do. Think of how much there is on the country's plate at the moment, and we have a very limited period every night, and I get a limited period for documentaries, though I get more than most, which is nice. So it is in the choosing that we play a fairly, I think, significant role and should play in the public debate, in the public dialogue, and have an opportunity to put things on the public agenda. It's the exciting part as well.
We've both worked overseas and in working overseas talked with the people who live in countries abroad about the way that America is seen, Americans are seen, policy here affects them there. And here in this country, it seems to me that in the year since September 11th, something substantial has changed, because for all the impact of the construction and then the destruction of the Berlin Wall, for all the impact of the most dramatic news stories that you covered in the Middle East, in Asia, in Africa, all the time that you worked as a foreign correspondent, there was always the ability to compartmentalize what the foreign correspondent was sending in as something that was happening over there. Mm. And certainly in our lifetime, the over there became over here on September 11th. And I guess as you're trying to figure out where television journalism is supposed to go in planning for an attack on Iraq, assuming that's going to happen, or in tracking the war on terror, does that mean that the rules of coverage have changed as well?
I actually think they changed even before the Berlin Wall came down, because with the advent of the Internet and the growth of the use of the Internet, we're moving already in the direction of a borderless world. What the Berlin Wall did, I think, for all of us generally, but certainly for journalism, it was to erase the two camps through which we had seen so much of our coverage in the world. You could go anywhere in the world as a foreign correspondent and do a story as seen through the American-Soviet competitive prism. Mm-hmm. And that no longer exists. And therefore, I think, as a people and as a government and as journalists, we have struggled to understand subsequently what it is about the world that is important. Is it AIDS in South Africa? Is it the Middle East struggle between Israelis and Palestinians? Is it the war in Kashmir between Indians and Pakistanis? So I think we're struggling, generally speaking, with that. The attack on the country on 9/11 focused the United States in a way we've never been focused before on the rise and potency of a very virulent, very anti-Western stream within Islam, which is, for a variety of reasons, I think, determined to hurt the United States and that which it represents. does not like the whole notion of the individual idea, which this country is so profoundly based on. And so that is one struggle. But I think it's related to a great many other struggles, and we have to keep sorting them out as we go along. Because if it was interesting to hear the president, when he first came to office, talking about a humble foreign policy and a humble relationship with the rest of the world. And if you look at the issuance on Friday of the sort of what one will start to call
the
Bush doctrine, in essence, it's much more militant and much more aggressive than I think the president imagined he was going to get to when he first got to office. And the change on 9/11 caused some of that. And I think the rise within certain elements of the administration to go after Saddam Hussein again, I think, has given new weight to it as well. But it is the struggle for the country in the 21st century. It is the struggle for policymakers, and it is certainly the struggle for journalists.
It'll also be the struggle for the support of American people, who will get their ideas about what works and what doesn't from the way the media presents the news of the Bush doctrine and the war. And the one thing that's changed since the Gulf War, if we want to just look at the past 10 years, is the rise in the more right-wing patriotism-boosting Fox Network, that sense of the world. And I'm curious if it nibbles at you that as you're trying to figure out where you want to be as anchor and senior editor at ABC, and there's the Media Research Center and the other people saying we're going to train our guns on anybody who questions the authority of the president in ways that haven't been done before, whether or not you're going, oh boy, does that mean that our line moves to the left, to the right?
You probably think it's a little bit provincial of me, but I think I'd tell them to read In Search of America at the moment, the book, because it's a reminder of we've been here before. You mentioned immigration. This is a nation of immigrants. That's the obvious thing to say. There have been waves of them in the past. There's a wave of at the moment. It changes the way the country sees itself because we have no, you know, one national ethnicity. We have no one national geography. And so I'm not the slightest bit surprised to see these waves of nativism that the country's had in its past against the new waves of immigration. It's been a long time in America before the conservative ideology in the country had as firm a place on in the national dialogue as it has had in the last half decade, I think. I personally think it's a good thing. And I take no exception to the fact that people on the right wish to move those of us who they deem are somewhere else on the political or ideological spectrum. I don't think they're always right, and they don't always listen necessarily, but that's as true on the left as well. But I think it's a reminder that you have to make room for as many people as you can in the national dialogue. You have to be certain that you have to remember that one of the good things about the press is that we are a legitimate check on government. And it's a little harder to check on government when the country is tense and has been attacked and people are feeling patriotic. I think you always want to be clear, what is the difference between patriotism and nationalism? I'm a huge supporter of patriotism. I'm a little less enthusiastic about nationalism.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Peter Jennings. In his work as a foreign correspondent, he has seen both patriotism and nationalism at its best and at its worst around the world. And as the country comes to terms with its current position in the war on terror and contemplates another war on top of that, how do we make sense of those emotions in this country? 1-800-423-TALK is the number to reach us. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, my guest is Peter Jennings, anchor and senior editor of ABC News World News. Tonight, we've been talking about the way that the coverage in this country has changed, will change, or can be altered in the months leading up to what's going to be a set of circumstances that none of us are particularly clear on at this point. If the war on terror continues and there is an attack on Iraq, and going back through the notes, trying to make sense of experience here and experience abroad. We came across a dispatch filed by my guest, Peter Jennings, 1972, from that infamous moment at the Olympic Games in Munich.
Jim, I am almost directly over the Israeli building. It will be a famous number before long. It's building 31. It's on Connollystrasse. It does appear to be confirmed, though anything confirmed today is difficult, that these guerrillas are from one of the very extreme left-wing groups, a group called Black September. Continuous delegations go forward, people here waiting, but unquestionably the mood becoming more tense.
Do you remember that?
I do very well, and in fact, you know, we're on the anniversary of...
30 years.
And ABC Sports did a wonderful film about it this year, but... Two things strike me. Apparently, early in the coverage, I identified these guys as having been from Black September. And somebody said, how did you, gosh, you were so experienced and you knew about this. I cannot for the life of me remember why I was able to identify them as Black September at the time. So I was getting credit for something I wasn't sure I knew. But I also realized in listening to that, we would not call them guerrillas today.
Yeah, the word jumped out at me as
that's
well.
That's right, jumps out at me too. This was a period of struggle in the Middle East. Always a period of struggle in the Middle East in which there was a great debate about, you know, who were the guerrillas and who were the terrorists. But terrorists were not common as a label in those days. Automatically they would be calling these men terrorists because they'd gone after civilian and there was not a legitimate battlefield involved. So that was the other thing.
You were based in Beirut at the time.
I was, and my boss, Rune Arledge, who's one of the great producers and broadcasters of the time, called me and said ABC was doing the Olympics in Munich. Would I like to have a rest from the Middle East? So he asked me to Munich to do all of the non-sports features for the 2.5 weeks. I thought it would be great. And, of course, then broke this huge story, which the Palestinians got onto the front pages of the world's newspapers in ways they'd never been before, even though they'd hijacked some planes to the Middle East, in the Middle East before. And, of course, this is what happened again in this country on 9/11. Terrorism got on the front pages and into our daily lives in ways it had never, never, ever been imagined by most Americans. I cannot get over, you know, having been at Munich and having, you know, seen the Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro assassinated around the corner from my building where I lived in Rome, covered the Red Brigade and others. You forget that even with Oklahoma City, vast majority of Americans felt immune from terrorism on these shores.
So does that mean, as you prepare for coverage in the months ahead, that the rules are different?
Well, the government would certainly like the rules to be different. If you listen to the Secretary of Defense, who has who's been the very public figure for the international campaign against Afghanistan and to some extent the campaign against terrorism, if you listen to the Attorney General John Ashcroft on a regular basis, you know they wish the rules to be different. And the debate for the country is whether or not we as a people wish the rules to be different. And most, if you believe in the polls, and I do to some extent, you believe that people acknowledge there's going to be have to some new balance between civil liberties and security. What the balance is, given we live in such a multi-ethnic society, I think is a very difficult challenge for all of us. And we see, for example, last week in Lackawanna in upstate New York and Buffalo, where they pick up these Americans of Yemeni descent and are absolutely 100% convinced in a public way, and we all go for it like nobody's business, that this is an Al-Qaeda cell up in upstate New York. And then you hear their defense attorneys point out the other side of the story. And you see the three young men picked up in Florida the other day on the comments of a woman who called in the police. And then you hear the other side of the story. I don't mean to settle on one side of the story or the other, but it's very important that we keep remembering there's sometimes more than one side of the story.
Interesting, though, that when you talk about the administration, because there are certainly those listening to us now who would have those decisions of balance determined not by journalists but by the administration in terms of where the lines ought to be drawn. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Orleans, Indiana. Nick's on the line. Hi, Nick.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's an honor to talk to Mr. Jennings.
Hey, Nick, how are you?
Good. My question, I guess I have, is where does the First Amendment stop or end regarding reporting a news story, especially in light of this amendment's assertion that everything is secret?
As this administration's assertion, you mean, rather than this amendment. Well, that, I think, Nick, is very much part of the debate. I think the first thing we should all do is become more familiar with the First Amendment and think of the five areas that it covers in national life. And then I think we can accept, I'm not sure we can accept, but I think we can accept that a large body of mainstream journalism in the country accepts the notion of national security and does not have any intention of putting American lives at risk. We pull our horns in and day out vis-a-vis the knowledge we know about a national security operation as opposed to what we are and have the freedom under the First Amendment to tell people. So I think it's not as if the media establishment is not, for the most part, a pretty responsible group of people. But as you know, by looking at the First Amendment polls, there are more people who think that we have too much freedom at the moment. And again, I don't think we should be surprised at that, given the tension in the country. So this struggle all the time about what the First Amendment means is an historic, rich part of the country's development. And it comes and it goes depending, support for the First Amendment comes and goes depending on the situation in the country. I'm not sure that's a very good answer, but...
Oh, that's fine. I appreciate that. I guess I just personally see so many of our freedoms and the First Amendment being eroded by certain aspects of, like, the Patriot Act, where the government can go into a library and force a librarian to give up any list of material somebody may have read or whatever. You know, granted, we're all scared of terrorism and things like that, but honestly, John Ashcroft scares me more than Al-Qaeda sometimes.
One of the things I think that you personally, given what I hear from you, will be encouraged by is, of course, the way the courts in the country have taken this on. And the question of secrecy in the First Amendment, I think, will come again to the Supreme Court in short order on a whole variety of issues. And I think we are indeed in the country fortunate. Again, there's no politics involved in this particularly, but that we have an active judiciary in the country which is prepared to deal with these essentially constitutional issues. And I think that makes for a very healthy nation.
Nick, thanks for your call. We're at 1-800-423-TALK to Madison, Wisconsin. Now Kay's on the line. Hi, Kay.
Good morning.
Morning, Kay.
I really appreciate the perspective of both of you as journalists and your foreign correspondent experience. I, in particular, would like both of you to speak to the effect that your Canadian roots have on not only journalism, but viewing the United States and being part of it, but not of it, at least not initially. I find the perspective very enlightening, but I'd like both of you to speak to that, the pros and the cons of...
Let Dick go first here, but just to pick up on one thing, to be not part of it originally, and it's quite true, we both came here, I think, because this was a bigger, exciting opportunity that did not exist for us in Canada. And like millions of people, we came here eager, I think, to share in the whole American experience and experiment. I'm reminded that 75 million people have come to this country in the last 25 years alone. We are two of them. Now, Dick, what do you think being Canadian originally makes a difference?
You'll know if you look to the Great White North that most people in Canada actually live along the 49th parallel within almost walking distance of the United States. That has something to do with climate and something to do with trade. But what it provides most Canadians with is this wonderful IMAX view of a country that allows you to see it from east to west just by sort of turning your head. And you are compelled to watch the story unfold. So I'll pick up what Peter's saying and say that to be a part of the unfolding and the coverage of the story is both fascinating as a journalist and a privilege to be here and to do it. But it's not that we turn our attention to the United States when we contemplate work here. We are raised watching this great widescreen film unfold.
Yeah, I would have said something slightly different, and it's one of the reasons I think, Kay, that I wanted to do this book with Todd Brewster. It's because if you come from somewhere else, willingly or not, or, sorry, either being chased or not being chased from whence you came, there's always, I think, this fascination to learn more about the country. I think growing up in Canada, which is a huge country with a tiny population, as Dick says, living along the frontier, you are obliged to learn more about influence than about power. If you grow up in America, you grow up with a rich sense that this is a powerful nation, which can, as we now see at the beginning of the century, have its way in the world if it wants to. Canadians have never had that opportunity. Canadians have had to go off to the international halls of whatever in the course of their history and use their influence to get ahead. I think coming here, you sense the difference between power and influence. And I think it's one of the reasons we become foreign correspondents, because much of the world has to get along on influence, and only some of the world has to get along on power. And I think that's why Canadians make pretty decent foreign correspondents.
I was talking with some friends in Canada over the weekend, Kay, and their reaction to the Bush doctrine delivered on Friday is one of almost utter puzzlement in terms of trying to figure out what does it mean, and is it an expression, Peter was talking about this a couple of minutes ago, is an expression of arrogance, or is it an expression of a new reality. I mean, the word arrogance was used by the New York Times in kind of reining back the administration on what it means. But I hope that's a bit of an answer to your question. Thanks for calling. We're going to Somerville, Massachusetts now, and Daniel is on the line. Hi, Daniel.
Hi there.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on the air. I think that, first of all, we heard a lot of talk about how there was going to be a great deal more concentration on world news and an awareness of the world after 9/11. And on national television and local television, I see just as myopic a view as ever. If it wasn't for the exact war on terrorism and what was happening in Afghanistan, I saw nothing of the rest of the world.
What were you expecting?
I was hoping for at least a little bit more concentration on where we were at in the world and what the world thought of us and an analysis of that. And instead, I find an uncritical, to the most part, uncritical view of what the government is saying, a kind of, more propaganda than ever on the national media. And the protest has been in tiny little media outlets that have no power. So, you know, I kind of feel that if the corporations own the television networks, then, you know, the job of the television networks is to lobotomize the people. And there's not going to be a lot of protest against the fact that the United States is becoming the first Western country to have a first strike war since Nazi Germany and communist Russia. So doesn't the media have some kind of obligation to have ethics and morality and the world view into the nightly news?
Peter.
Well, you've said a lot, Daniel, and I agree with some and not. And I am puzzled at the struggle. I'd love to be omnipotent for a week, right? I'm puzzled at the struggle we sometimes have, no matter what level we work at, in interesting Americans in the rest of the world in many ways. On World News Tonight, which is only one broadcast, we are deeply interested in the changes in China. We are deeply interested in the crisis of AIDS in Southern Africa. We've all long been deeply interested and involved in coverage of the Middle East. But I think you're right in this respect. I think that we have a hard time focusing on more than one subject at a time. And with the United States engaged in Afghanistan, which is, let's call that the military dimension of foreign policy, and now contemplating a preemptive attack, as you say, against Saddam Hussein, you now have the diplomatic but power component of this issue you bring up, United States and the rest of the world. We do tend, I think, to stay fairly focused on one issue. We cover a lot more business today. After all, the globalism has meant that Americans don't sell their products down the street anymore. They sell them with all of the attendant influence of culture and economic philosophy in other parts of the world. We do more of that.
But, Peter, what about the corporate influence on television?
I have to tell you, a lot of people don't ever want to believe this. So I work for ABC News, which is owned by a huge corporation named Disney. Disney can make our life pretty miserable if it chooses in one respect only, and that's financial. And these are tight times for big, huge corporations.
But you can't send a correspondent
I can send a correspondent anywhere we want. We can send a correspondent anywhere we want. So,
but you're constrained then by the finances of it.
But right. I don't think, Daniel, you're correct to criticize the corporations for what you perceive as our failings in the news business. Those, if they are failings, are our failings. They're not because someone in the Disney Corporation tells us we can't go hither, thither, and yon. But I do think you are right in this one respect. We do sometimes appear to have difficulty of balancing more than one idea on the spoon at a time.
What about the idea, though, that as the media world becomes a part of the corporate world and as you and I age, that we end up representing too much of an establishment view of this country's politics, world politics, and what Daniel says he's looking for is just not being found
in the establishment media. The mainstream establishment media in America has always been called the establishment media, in part because it has largely represented the establishment. We represent mainstream, or try to broadcast for the most part, to mainstream America, and I, as a reader or a viewer or a listener, if I want something of a more finite, I want a more finite cut on life, I too have to go looking elsewhere. And I think it's made a little more difficult, and I think Daniel picks this up and well, it's made a little more difficult by the explosion of media in cable and on radio as well, in that we have all are arguing and struggling for a smaller slice of the pie than we had 25 and 30 years ago. My wife's father, 35 years ago, was one of the producers of all the great white paper documentaries at NBC when whole evenings were taken over for a public airing of great public issues in the country. It doesn't happen anymore. I've got 6 hours recently on In Search of America, and I thought I was really ahead of the game. So you can't deny changing times.
Daniel, thanks for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Jennings, anchor and senior editor of ABC News World News Tonight, is out of the studio because he's traveling around the country talking about a new book that he's helped put together called In Search of America. Todd Brewster is the co-author with Peter Jennings. And for those people in the Boston area, a reminder that Peter and Todd will be reading from the book this afternoon, 12:30 at Borders Books and Music in Boston. That's on School Street, 12:30 this afternoon. The name of the book, In Search of America. Excuse me, our number is 1-800-423-8255. If you'd like to call in, chat with Peter about television news today and television news into the uncertain times that we're heading, now's your chance. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio this hour, Peter Jennings. He is the anchor and senior editor of ABC News World News Tonight. And we're going straight out to the lines to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gwen's on the line. Hi, Gwen.
Hi. I have more of a comment than a question, and I would appreciate if you could respond about media responsibility. I have a sense in the media that war in Iraq is portrayed as being inevitable, and I feel that, like voters voting for the candidate who they think is most likely to succeed, when the media portrays war in Iraq as inevitable, they are aiding Bush's fight to try and create this feeling that war is necessary and without really seriously considering other options.
I think you make an excellent point. We call our coverage rarely, not all the time, but occasionally on the broadcast, the road to war with a huge question mark about it. Because I'm not absolutely sure that the country is going to go to war in Iraq. There may be other ways out of this. There may be ways to avoid war. It may be in the final analysis, President and those in the administration who are talking a lot about war now may not wish to go to war. But I do think you're right in when certain people put, we were just talking, Dick and I put showdown with as part of the identity of their continuing coverage, then it does tend to feed the fever to some extent and at least feed the notion of inevitability. And I don't think it's inevitable. And when we do it in the media, I think it's wrong.
But something's got to feed your coverage when the CNN or the Fox Cable 24-hour news set that you know, is up on, on one wall of your office as you check what the competition is up to, you know, constantly has those faces and those heads talking about it.
Yeah, I think that cuts both ways. I think that as we've got more and more media in the country, we went through a period early on when I think we were pushed around by the other people that were showing up on the block, and they were doing something, and it seemed very energized, and I think we sort of followed them for a while. I think we're going the other direction now to some extent, and we keep reminding ourselves, and I keep trying to remind the audience, that CNN and Fox and MSNBC all represent a tiny slice of life, and they get much more attention in the press, I think, than their audience sizes warrant.
They're small, but, you know, they're the ones that are on in the congressional offices and the newsrooms around the country, so their influence is larger than the numbers that show up.
I quite agree, and I think you have to keep reminding people that I was once in Tehran, and I was about to do an interview with Hashemi Rafsanjani, who was then the president, and the chef de cabinet said, well, you know, I almost gave this to CNN instead of you. I said, listen, if you want to be seen all the foreign ministries of the world, you should give it to CNN. And if you want to be seen by the American people, it probably better chance you should give it to ABC. But it does take a while, I think, for people to understand that. But I do think that the cables are less influential in our life than they were a year or 2 years ago. And I think that's partly because they're having their own quite desperate competition at times between them. And you've seen them change in the last couple of years.
Gwen, do you go along with that?
You know, I'm more of a radio listener than a TV watcher myself. I'm just concerned that even on the more liberal stations like, BUR, NPR, that the rhetoric is so fierce. And I have a sense that that there are other views in other countries that Americans are sadly not really aware of.
Yeah, I would throw a bouquet here to NPR. I listen to NPR every morning, a morning edition. And one of the things that I'm pleased by every morning is to hear the overseas reporting. So I think... Again, it's a little bit what you look for on your radio dial or your television dial. There is ample opportunity to hear the debate as it's being waged in other countries. In America, you just have to look for it on occasion.
Gwen, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255, Exeter, New Hampshire, and Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. Actually, this sort of follows Gwen a little bit. My feeling is journalists aren't asking the right questions because the quality of journalism has changed, that they're more celebrity-driven, less experienced. They don't have the years in the field, say, that Peter did or someone like Jim Hoagland or Lauren Jenkins.
And I apologize for interrupting or laughing there because Jim Hoagland and Lauren Jenkins, who, of course, is now with NPR, he was the Newsweek correspondent in Beirut with me, and Jim was the Washington Post correspondent and is now, of course, a national security commentator.
Well, and I, in the interest of disclosure, was also there at the same time.
Is this Bob Azzi?
Yes.
I thought I recognized your voice.
Hi, Peter.
How are you, Robert?
but I wonder if you have that feeling that people are more sort of being trained in communications and appearance than they are in sort of political science and economics. And so they don't hold the feet of the Congress and the administration and other journalists, in fact.
This is the Ashley Banfield style of reporting.
Me school of journalism or the
Well, without knocking... Ashley Banfield completely. I mean, she did go places, and I give her credit for getting dirty, and I think that's important. But I think that it is true, Bob, that, and by the way, it's really nice to hear your voice. It is true that I think the current generation of journalists haven't had as much opportunity as the Koppels and the Jennings of ABC did to go see the world on somebody else's money. I think that's tougher today. And so as Dick Gordon was talking with Brian Williams coming on to replace Tom Brokaw at NBC at some point, you know, Brian has not had the same opportunity to go and see the world as we did. I don't think that makes for a not as good a journalist. It does often make for journalists that's had less familiarity with the rest of the world. But I don't think that I think the quality of journalism is what the news organizations make it to be. A lot of people want to get into television because television is this, you know, deeply powerful thing in our lives, and a lot of people seem to think it's exciting to be on television, and I'd like them to capitalize the N in news rather than the T in television. But I think if you watch carefully, I find as many people who are dedicated and interested in the world wanting to come into the trade today as there was in my generation. But it is harder, no question.
I think it's harder, but I think without that background, I think the right questions just don't get asked. I think it's not as deep as it used to be.
I think you may be talking about something slightly differently, and I forgive my presumption, which is we now, for example, see the Pentagon briefing and the White House briefing on television every day. That is on cable every day. And I sit in my office sometime, and I say, those characters, when they ask the tough question, you see, and I'm always accusing John McCarthy, who's our brilliant Pentagon correspondent, why they aren't tougher in the Pentagon briefing.
Sure.
Well, we are all, I think, aware in the country today that we are, the moment is very tense. There is a question of do you want to defy government all the time, which you don't, and you want to push government. But I think when people are looking over your shoulder at times, you're a little more reluctant, if you're one of those there in the public view, to be criticizing government as vigorously and as openly as you might have if you were slightly more anonymous.
Bob, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
We're at 1-800-423-TALK. And to...
Great photographer, Bob Azzi, I have to tell you. Great, great photographer. Can I tell one story?
Yeah, sure.
He took a very, very famous portrait of Anwar Sadat. And we got Anwar Sadat up at some ungodly hour, 4 o'clock in the morning, to take him out to the Sinai. This was after the 1973 war, so that Bob could take his picture with the entire Sinai behind him.
Where would we have seen the photo?
He took it actually for ABC, and it was for a film I did on Sadat's life. And it's been a tremendous keepsake to have that. Thank you, Robert.
To a highway somewhere in Connecticut, Ron's joining us. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Thank you for putting me on. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. I've never called a radio station before, but listening to your show, I keep thinking that I'm a news hound. I like the news, which is why I listen to your show. But I'm 23 years old. I don't know anybody my age who watches any of the three networks. I mean, I know some people watch Fox and maybe MSNBC, but I don't know anyone who watches, any ABC, NBC, or CBS.
Why is that, Ron?
I was going to ask him something.
I don't know. I guess my grandpa watches, those stations. I don't know. I think Fox appears to be more balanced. I don't know. There's a feeling that the disconnect between us and what you guys are showing on the TV, it appears to be more oriented towards, I don't know, the older folks. And I think until you connect with, you're going to lose influence unless you connect with people my age. Try to appear more balanced or try to appear more
You're struggling for that word, and I think that it's a struggle for figuring out what you're getting from one and not getting from the other, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know why. I'm embarrassed to say I don't want you. And, I apologize for that. I'm sure your show is... I don't even know somebody my age who watches any of the three networks. And, I mean, I don't know the statistics, but I'm willing to bet that the average age is 60. I don't know.
Well, let's hear from Peter, who actually looks at those numbers.
Let me just first of all say, Ron, when you said that you watched Fox because it was more balanced, I could hear a lot of people around the country cringing when you say that. But put that aside for a second. You're quite right that the audience for the television network news, in part because it's on at such an awkward time of day in many parts of the country, is indeed grayer than you. And the 23-year-old, who I would love to have in the next generation of news watcher, is someone I'd like to have very much engaged with what we do. But I think the only thing I can say to you is this. I do wish you'd watch at least once or twice to see for yourself whether or not you think we are balanced and whether or not you think we have anything to offer you. We report a fair amount on cutting-edge technology, which is, I think, interesting to young people. We report quite a lot on cutting-edge medicine, not just feel-good medicine, but the changes in the country. We report a lot on foreign affairs. We report a lot on lifestyle in America. We report on the emerging, the rise and fall of the dot-com business, all of which, if I were 23 years old, I think I would be at least marginally interested
in. But something's wrong with the place that you are that doesn't make it easy for Ron and other 23-year-olds who are friends of his to find you at that time of day. Is that
Well, without knowing more about Ron, I can't really answer the question fully. But, you know, World News Tonight is sometimes on at 5:30 or 6:30 in parts of the country, which I think is ludicrous. We've given up our 7 o'clock time on the edge of prime time, which the networks had for many, many years. I don't think they ever should have given up, but I agree it makes it very difficult for people who are... The second largest reason that people do not watch the evening news is because they don't have a television set. Now, you figure that out.
What's the first largest reason?
The first is because they choose to watch something else. But the second largest reason, they don't have a television set in their car, in their bus, or on their train, or they're still at work. And a lot of people, not as many as we like to think, a lot of people can, in fact, get their news on their computer. Ron, I would suggest one thing to you, which just suddenly occurred to me. Sometime when you're sitting at your computer around 6:30 or thereabouts, or any time of the day or night, go to abcnews.com. Just for the heck of it, as a favor to me, if you feel so inclined, and punch in World News Tonight, which you can stream at any time of the day or night. That really is the new world order, I think, sometime down the road. And if you find it imbalanced, call me and tell me, please.
Well, I would certainly do that tonight.
Ron, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
You know, Peter, we started out by talking about history, and it's not uncommon that when we talk about what's happening now that we wind up back there. If we go back to coverage of the First World War and the Second World mm-hmm. War, there was, in that time, reporting in uniform. Mm-hmm. There was a mm-hmm. home team attitude. Mm-hmm. And I get not direct but indirect senses from the people who we talk to and callers on the program that there was something comforting about that.
Something that, noble, even.
And we look back as journalists at the reporting of Edward R. Murrow, and we don't make fun of it at the time. But is there a way of making use of that and not compromising yourself as a journalist in 2002, preparing for another war?
I think actually you'd have great difficulty getting journalists into uniforms today. And I think in part because the relationship between the military establishment and the press is by and large generally bad.
Okay, skip the uniform part. But,
all right,
but that sense of reporting for the home side. Is that?
I don't know, I know who I know. I know a lot of journalists. I know a lot of foreign correspondents. I know a lot of guys, men and women, who cover Washington. I don't know anybody who's out to screw the government. I don't know anybody who is on the other side. I don't know anybody who wouldn't at a crucial moment decide to save lives rather than expend lives on the basis of loose lips or free information. But the military establishments made it very difficult in one respect. They're always seem to be fighting the last war. Many of them are still fighting the Vietnam War, which many of them still believe they didn't lose, but the media lost for them, even though there's not a study in anywhere to sustain this particular argument. So if to pick up Gwen's point, if war is inevitable in Iraq, I think when people try to get around the military and try to cover this war without the cooperation of the military establishment, because we got a pretty good idea already, they don't want to tell us anything. And that's bad for democracy, too.
Thanks for coming in. Peter Jennings, anchor of ABC News World News Tonight, co-author of In Search of America with Todd Brewster. And as I mentioned a little earlier in the program, if you're in the Boston area, Peter and Todd will be talking about their new book at Borders Books and Music in Boston on School Street, 12:30 this afternoon. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. This is WBUR. Just ahead in the